You're listening to the Weekly Sermon Podcast from Trinity Church Denver. To find out more about Trinity, visit our website at trinitychurchdenver.org. And be sure to subscribe to this podcast in your favorite podcast player to get the latest episodes as soon as they're available. And now, please enjoy the sermon.
One of my favorite books by C.S. Lewis, in fact, probably one of my favorite books of all time, is a book called Till We Have Faces. Till We Have Faces is C.S. Lewis recasting an old myth. And in that old myth, he has at the center of that story two characters, and I'm going to look at it. Aurel. There's lit majors here who can tell me Aurel. Aurel. So I mispronounced it in my head for years now. But anyway, I almost said Psyche, but it's Istra. Istra plays from the old mythology. Plays the role of Psyche. But at the heart of, without going into the entire narrative, at the heart of this story is at the heart of, what lay at the heart of basically everything C.S. Lewis wrote. And these two characters represent two sides of a coin, two angles on interpreting the world and understanding the world that really runs through every single thing that C.S. Lewis ever put to paper. Whether you're talking about the Chronicles of Narnia, or you're talking about his nonfiction, this is the battle that he saw unfolding in the world. And I said it before you because I believe that's the battle that's going to actually unfold in this room over the next 30 minutes. Aurel represents a kind of disdain for the divine, a kind of resistance to, at the heart, a resistance to what she saw as grotesque, what she saw as dark, and what she's finally exposed as what she claims to not really believe in the whole course of her life. But at the heart of who she is, she's a practical woman who wants to rule her kingdom, function well, make sure that there's crops to be grown, make sure that that her enemies are defeated. She wants things to get done, and the divine, God, religion, all of those things, at best, simply get in the way of her accomplishing the tasks that she set out to accomplish as queen. In the end of the book, she's exposed as actually the gods that she claims to not believe in, she actually despises and hates. In contrast to her is her sister Istra. Istra is beautiful. She loves beauty. She seems whimsical to everyone around her, but she loves the divine. She submits herself to the God of this kingdom, even to the point of her own sacrifice to this God, that she might be united with him, that she might know him, that she might know him and delight in him all the days of her life. But in her view of the world, this is how the world is. There is a God who demands blood. There's a God who is mysterious. There's a God who is beautiful. There's a God we don't quite understand. And for Istra, she sees at the center of the universe a God, and she delights in it. For her sister Aurel, she sees the claim that at the center of the universe is a God, and she hates him, despises him. This is a quote from Aurel. That's why I say it makes no difference whether you're fair or foul. That there should be gods at all. Theirs are misery and bitter wrong. There's no room for you and us in the same world. You're a tree in whose shadow we cannot thrive. We want to be our own. This contention, this claim, I think lay at the heart of every single one of us in this room. This is the bottom line problem, the universe. It's not that we think God is evil. It's not really, doesn't matter at all whether God is good or evil. It's that there is a God at all. There is a God to be dealt with, submitted to, listened to. Because if there is a God, and it's the God of Revelation 4, it unravels everything we think about the world. And in the end, it displaces us and our lives and our concerns and our desires and our wealth and our poverty and our problems. It displaces them radically from the center. And if we can be honest just for a second, that's what we hate more than anything. That's what presses upon us as we interact with other people and their problems begin to annoy us, their personalities begin to annoy us. That's what frustrates us beyond just laughing about it when we're sitting at a campsite and there's literally the mosquito apocalypse. And it goes beyond just, oh, this is an interesting, odd, annoying thing to why? Why the one weekend we come camping, there's 6 million mosquitoes crawling in, like evolutionarily like developed enough to know that if they crawl in between my pant crevice, they can bite me and I'll get the ones on my arm. But like it is what confronts us everywhere with the reality that we're not at the center of the universe. So we step now into Revelation chapter 4. And that's what it's going to confront us with. If you'll remember in chapter 2 and 3, for those of you who haven't been here, John has been addressing 7 very specific churches and the problems they're facing. 2 of those churches are faithful. 2 of those churches have clung to Jesus. They've confessed Jesus. They're faithfully worshiping Jesus. They haven't compromised with the culture around us. They also haven't kind of secluded themselves but within kind of the Jewish community in those cities. They've stood in the middle. They've declared their love for Jesus. They've tried to participate in the life of the cities that they're in, and they've remained faithful. The other 5 churches have not. They've either isolated themselves, kind of taking the moral high ground, while kind of resisting talking about Jesus too much, and so kind of hiding out within the Jewish community, or they've kind of held on to Jesus, but as was permitted within the Roman Empire, they would hold on to Jesus and also sacrifice to pagan gods and participate in kind of the paganism that surrounded them in the cities that they lived in. And so John is now beginning to address these churches that are about to face massive temptation. Some of these churches are about to face massive persecution. They're going to see their moms and their dads and their brothers and their sisters, and some of them, they're going to see their children dragged out in the streets and killed. They're facing real problems. Some of them, they don't know how they're going to get food on the table because their faithfulness to Jesus is causing them to be excluded from the local economy. Some of them are being asked by Jesus in these chapters to take stands, to declare things in the midst of real world problems that they're going to cost them massively. And so you would expect, I would expect, to get to chapter 4 of Revelation after he's confronted these churches and for Jesus to offer these churches something really practical, something to hold on to. Maybe 3 principles for good living, 3 things to hold on to when times are dark. It's always 3. 4 is too many. 2 is not enough. 3 principles for how to have a healthy job life and work-life balance. You would expect something to come to them now in chapter 4 that can be practically and permanently helpful. And it does, but it's not what you expect. But Jesus invites John to come and see. It is a scene. And we've been kind of working our way through the nice chapters of Revelation. And now we've arrived in chapter 4. And we get to the weird stuff, but not the really weird stuff, just the halfway weird stuff. And what John is going to set before them, what Jesus wants John to set before them, is not the thing that you would expect. He invites them to come, John to come, and then to describe for these churches a scene in heaven. Now I don't want you to misunderstand what he's portraying. When he describes a scene in heaven, what he's not describing is some far off kind of geographical place, kind of far off somewhere. And if we could go to that place, we would see what John saw. No, what John is going to describe, well, in fact, the way he even describes him coming into this vision, is that a window stands open. And heaven was not some far off place for John or anyone in the first century. Heaven was everything above the ground. In other words, it was the fabric of reality itself. And so what John says is, a window stood open. He was told to come up there, to come into this place. And what he's going to describe for these 7 churches, what he's going to describe for us, is a vision of reality as it actually is. But what John is going to do for us is not tell us kind of a far-off future. Not yet. What he wants these churches to see in the midst of their trouble, in the midst of their suffering, in the midst of their problems, in the midst of their temptations, is he wants them to see something they can't see in their day-to-day life. Something that we can't see in our day-to-day life. But it's absolutely real and is absolutely here, is absolutely now. And if we can see it, it will utterly reorient the way we see everything else happening in our lives, because this is the context in which all of those things happen. This is not some far-off future. This is now. This is here. And this is the world as it is actually ordered and how it should actually function. Get? So what John wants to give us is a worldview, a pair of glasses through which we can see and interpret and understand our lives, and understand politics, and understand the economy, and understand business, and understand raising children, and understand everything about our lives right now. So what does John see? What does John describe? Right off the bat, the very first thing he confronts us with is a throne, and one who is seated on the throne. And one commentator noted that's a horrific translation of the Greek. That the best way to understand what John describes as him seeing is he sees enthronement enthroned. It's just a double use of the same word. He sees absolute sovereignty sovereignly. He sees the one who bears all authority in authority. He sees and literally, it is enthronement enthroned. He sees a throne at the center of the universe, and one who sits upon it is absolute, pure, undefiled sovereignty. The center of the universe is not you or I. The center of the universe is not political forces. The center of the universe is not the family. At the center of the universe is not the Republican Party or the Democratic Party. At the center of the universe is a God who sits enthroned above everything. Here is the one who is absolute authority. Here is the one who is absolute power. Here is the one who has absolute claim on every breath you breathe and every animal that lives and every square inch of reality. At the center of the universe is a throne, and there is one who is seated on it, who reigns forever and ever and ever. Are you okay with that? Do you know what that means? Personal. You aren't the center of the universe. Your needs, your desires, your comforts, your ambitions, they are not the center of the universe. Your concerns, they're not the center of the universe. Your authority, whatever authority you presume to wield, is not ultimate. You and I and everything else in this world is subject to someone, answerable to someone, should be submitted to someone. This one who is seated with absolute authority, uncompromising, undiluted sovereignty. And I think this is, if we're honest, is what we hate. This is what bugs us about God. It's what bugs me about God. I can handle a God who functions as kind of a chaplain, a moral advisor. Don't steal that. Don't punch that person in the face. Don't sleep with that person. I can handle that. I need a moral advisor. Humble enough to acknowledge that. I can deal with someone who's there to bless me and give me stuff. Especially if he's like all powerful. You know who doesn't want a genie? A God who can make me rich. I don't know if I'm famous, but rich, super rich. A God who can make me succeed in the job I want to pursue. A God that can make my children really well-behaved. Awesome kids. They are awesome kids, but well-behaved awesome kids. They're all well-behaved. It becomes harder as they get older. So, who makes them do exactly what I want them to do and not what they want to do. I can handle a God who is there to kind of bring me advice, a God who is there to kind of morally kind of be a compass for me. I can handle a God who isn't the center, but the moment he demands to be at the center, the moment he presumes to be sovereign, the moment he presumes to contain and to have and to exercise absolute moral and spiritual and physical and economic and social and political authority over every single facet of my life and everyone else's, who can handle a God like that? What Jesus declares to these churches and declares to us is that the center of the universe is a God seated on a throne with absolute, undiluted, uncompromising, unchallengeable authority. Now, the implications of this we're going to step into a little bit, but I want to hint there before we go there. This means that everything is relative to him. Everything's ultimate meaning and purpose is found in him. There are no side jobs. There are no facets of reality or your life that are not ultimately measured and submitted to and answerable to him. Not your job, not your marriage, not your children, not math, not science, not history. There are educational implications here. There is nothing in the world. There's nothing in your lives. There's not one word that you speak, one thought in your head that in the end is not ultimately answerable to the one who is at the center of the universe, absolute and sovereign and authoritative. But we'll come back to that. Okay. So, we have this one on the throne, but what is he like? Is he an ogre? Is he ugly and green? Who is this one who is seated on the throne? And everything else in the book is going to unfold that for us, but we get a glimpse now as John describes his appearance. It says he had the appearance of, so he was, this is kind of like saying he looked like something like jasper and carnelian and a rainbow that had the appearance of an emerald. So here is jasper, carnelian, a rainbow that looked like an emerald. He tells us there's flashes of lightning. So something involving light and color. And in case you don't have any jaspers laying around, jasper is like a white stone. It's often confused with a diamond. It is a pure, white, beautiful stone. Secondly, it is carnelian. It's a scarlet stone. So we have kind of clear, white shininess. And then we have red shininess, and then an emerald, and so you have green shininess, but the green is like a rainbow, and then in it all is lightning, which I think all of it is simply to say what he's trying to describe for us is indescribably beautiful. It is light and color shining at you from every which angle, and it is moving, and it is simply stunning. So the one who is seated on the throne, the one bearing all authority, absolute authority, is light and color and beauty. He is indescribably beautiful. Have you ever been to an old cathedral, like an old big one? It was in Notre Dame a few years ago, and to stand and to see the light. And there's a place you can stand. You can see I forget what they're called. They look like a giant round flower, but it's just a giant stained glass window on that end. And then there's and you can stand at the crux, and you can see the two on either side, and you can look, and it's just color and light, and it's overwhelming, and it doesn't sit still. It's never stationary. It's constantly moving, which is why pictures of these things never do them adequate, because when you take a picture, you're just catching one moment, but the very next moment, like, it's different. The colors look differently. They shine differently. The light and the angles are all different. This is how John describes the one who is seated on the throne with absolute authority. Indescribable beauty. And the sound he describes lightning and thunder and rumblings. The word there means literally shaking. That his voice, his presence is light and color and is indescribably beautiful, and it is sound. It shakes the very core of who you are. Have you ever been to like a really loud concert? Like you sat too close at Red Rocks, or you just went to a show at the Ogden. Like anywhere in the Ogden. And they turned the subs on, and it's like, the first time I went to a concert there, I thought there's no way you make it out of here without hearing loss. Like you're shaking, your chest is shaking, your ears are ringing after it is rumblings. It is sound that envelops you and shakes you and shakes everything around you. So this one who is seated on the throne, the one who is enthronement enthroned, here is sovereignty itself, seated on the throne, the one who has absolute authority over everything, he is beauty and sound that envelops, that consumes, that is almost indescribably beautiful. And then John begins to describe the things around the throne. And there are three things I want to point to. At first, he says there's a sea, like glass, like crystal. Well, the sea to anyone in the first century, I actually preached on Revelation 4 in California near a beach one time. They didn't like this next point, but you're in Colorado, so you will. The sea to anyone in the first century, the sea represented the place where evil was. It was a place that was... It was a place where the monsters were. It was a place where your friends went out fishing at night to catch fish because they needed more fish to feed their family, and they never came back because a storm blew in and destroyed their boat. It was the place where chaos was, evil was. That was where the monsters dwelled. But notice the sea here. It is like glass, like crystal. All the chaos in the world, all the monsters in the world are as nothing, as crystal, as glass before the one who sits upon the throne. There's like three sermons there. But just that picture alone tells us the nature of his authority. He is not at war in this world. There are no challenges to his authority. There are no challenges to his beauty and his strength. The seeming chaos that Annabeth felt was great. On the plane, I was trying to imagine flipped upside down. He had me until it flipped upside down, and then I'm out of there. So the seeming chaos that she's experiencing in that moment is as crystal, as glass to the sovereign one of the universe. He steers that plane and lands that plane. It is peace and calm. He owns everything with a kind of sovereignty that governs even your chaos. But on the throne, not just a sea of glass, but also he describes 24 elders. Now, there's been this kind of endless debate over who the 24 elders are and what they represent. They're going to come back to us kind of again and again and again in this book. And they always do the exact same thing. And they're the best characters in the book. They always fall down. That's like what they're there to do. They're not there to do anything except for take whatever's on their head, throw it on the ground, and fall down. And then they say stuff. But the funny thing is they just keep falling and getting up and falling and getting up and falling and getting up. And they never get bored with it. But who are these 24 elders? Well, the 24 elders represent kind of the whole history of the people of God. This is a message to those seven churches, and it's a message to us today that right now you sit surrounding the throne of God, in the presence of God. This is what it means to be the people of God. This isn't some far-off future. This is where you live your life now, today. When you go to lunch today, you're not leaving the throne room of God because you're not in this room. No, you exist. You live forever and ever and ever and ever, seated, standing, hopefully falling down again and again and again in the presence of the one who is seated on a throne and reigns forever and ever. This is what it means to be the people of God. And the 24 elders represent us, all of God's people, the 12 tribes of Israel, and the 12 apostles, our representatives, our a picture of who we are and where we live. And last, the four living creatures. This is where stuff gets weird. Because they're full of eyes. Okay? One has the face of a lion, one has the face of an ox, one has the face of a man, one has the face of an eagle. They have wings. So who are these four living creatures? We've seen them actually before in the Bible. In the book of Isaiah, Isaiah describes the cherubim surrounding these angelic figures that surround the throne of God. We've seen them actually in the book of Ezekiel, where Ezekiel describes the cherubim again, that they're always attending, always pointing to something about the nature and character of God, and generally always pointing to his holiness. So why are there four of them? And why do they have these faces? Well, two different reasons. One of the things we're going to come across again and again as we read this book is that John always uses numbers to point to something else. Numbers rarely just mean numbers in the book of Revelation. They always point to some substantive reality, some meaning beyond beyond just the number itself. And so the number four generally always has some connotation of fullness, but usually in particular having to do with the fullness of the earth, the fullness of creation itself. You remember the four corners of the earth, that kind of language. This is the kind of language that's used over and over again in the first century, anytime in apocalyptic literature in particular, as it describes four. You have we're going to see the four angels in chapter 8. We're going to see them actually again and again and again. They're holding back, kind of they're governing the edges of the created universe. So what John says is here, one, whatever these creatures are, they represent everything in creation. And then we have a further clue along those lines because of these four faces. These were in kind of Greek mythology, in the language of the first century, particularly in apocalyptic kinds of literature. These faces represented every created being, particularly when you saw them together. So here's the picture John's drawing. One, close to the throne, surrounding the throne, are the people of God. All of the people of God from the Old Covenant and the New Covenant gathered in the presence of the one seated on the throne. And then surrounding the throne is all of creation itself. And what is creation doing right now? When you pull out down 25th and you get to the light, and you see Sloan's Lake and you see trees. But when you pull out an I-70 later and you see mountains. If you go outside tonight and you see the colors of the sky changing from blood red and orange and blue and purples, what is creation doing? It is saying over and over and over again, from the beginning of creation until the end of time itself, just shouting, declaring, holy, holy, holy is the Lord God Almighty, who was and is to come. There are no random trees or random houses or random cities. There are no mountains that are just placed there to kind of be there. And there is no ocean that is just kind of, oh, there's a big body of water. No, all of them serve one purpose, and all of them have been doing that purpose over and over and over again for thousands and thousands and thousands of years, and they will continue to do that same thing over and over and over again. If only you'll have ears to hear it, that they are declaring to you, they are shouting to you, God is holy. He's holy. He's holy. There is not one square inch of the earth. There is not one person on the earth, no matter what missionaries have made it where, that has not heard shouted to them. There is a God. There is a God seated on a throne, and he is holy, holy, holy. He is almighty. He is filled with power and honor and glory. This song reverberates everywhere. If at the center of the universe is a throne, then all of creation exists for one purpose: declare the worth and the glory and the holiness of this God. If only you'll hear it. And then in hearing that confession, what do the elders do? Well, they fall down. And they begin to worship him. They begin to shout. They're not going to sing until next week. Next week, it's going to be a party. But this week, they just say, "Worthy are you, our Lord and God, to receive glory and honor and power. For you created all things, and by your will they existed and were created." But what John describes for us is how the world was meant to work. How it's meant to work even now. A creation flooded with beauty and glory and weirdness and majesty and the way that economics work and the way that that's all part of creation, by the way. The way that people can take grapes and turn it into wine. I mean, this is magic. The way that it can take grains, and if you make them rot, it turns into beer. Like all of those kinds of things. Mountains and oceans and dolphins that jump out of the ocean and trees and all of it is meant to confess as loudly as possible, reverberating through the whole of the universe, every square inch of the universe, even into this room, even into your afternoon and beyond your afternoon naps, shouting to you, there is a God, there is one who is seated on a throne who is holy, holy, holy. And then the people of God were meant to see that. Over and over and over again, as a gift. God just telling us what he's like, telling us how beautiful he is, how kind he is, how merciful he is, how glorious he is, how beautiful he is, how loud he is. We were meant to see that everywhere. And fall down again and again and again in worship, declaring his worth. This is what the world is for. This is what every breath you breathe is for. To behold the beauty and the sovereignty of this God and to respond in worship. Now, if this is true, the ramifications touch everything. It means that there is no portion of your life that should not, that must not have God at the center. He must be there, touching, ruling, everything in your life subject to him. For those of you that are parents in this room, it means that your greatest task, your central task, the thing you've been tasked with as a parent, is to bring every facet of their life, math, science, history, reading, books, all books, even apocalyptic books, all kinds of books, to bring all of them subject to the one who is seated on the throne. It means, as your marriage is about God. It is about declaring his worth forever and ever and ever. It means that your husbands, how you treat your wives, is not just about, hey, you following some sort of moral code and being nice. And no, at the end of the day, it is about reflecting to her the worth, the holiness, the glory, the beauty of God in millions of tiny ways. And the way that you, the tone that you take, and the way that you speak, and the way that you serve, and the way that you love. It means your job is about God. Your money is about God. Your house is about God. Your relationships are about God. They are subject to him. They are answerable to him. And they are put there to reflect him. The universe is his, and he is at the center. And nothing is not ultimately relative to him. The beauty of this God, this holy, holy God, is that he is beautiful, he is sovereign, he is filled with all authority, and he is good. Don't forget where this all started. He calls to his people, come up here. He invites the 24 elders, and they exist in his presence, welcomed into his presence. This God is not far off. He's not distant. He's not cold. He is warm, and he invites us into his presence to enjoy him, to experience him, and to know him. So today we end here, where we always end, and it's suitable that it's a table. It's a table with wine and bread. And what's fascinating is this God who is kind, this God who is beautiful, this God who is sovereign, at the center of our worship, the command that he gives the church is, as often as you gather together, come to this table. The center of what it means to worship him is to be invited to eat and to drink, and to be invited there by grace. A God who has dealt with our sin, as we're going to see next week, has dealt with all sin in the body and the blood of Jesus, and invites us now into his presence to know this King, to love this King, and to worship this King. I'm going to pray.